This is Daniel Mata. It is June 13th, 2012. I am at the Museum of Seminole County History interviewing Bobby Martin. If we could just start, could you just tell me where you're born?
Yes, sir. I was born in Tampa, Florida, Hillsborough County.
And what year was that?
1944.
So what brought you over to Central Florida?
My dad's employment, basically.
And what was he in?
Well, at that time, I believe he was working for the Imperial Oil Company. I believe he was. And I was about 3 or 4 years old when we moved up here from Tampa.
And you said a little earlier that you fished with him. Did he have experience fishing in the fishing industry as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, to get to that, we'll have to fast forward to 1960 or 61.
Okay, we'll take a little slower then. When you got here, could you describe your house, your house, neighborhood, how it was then?
Sure. We moved up here. I'll tell you this. My dad bought a house in Tampa when I was a baby. My mother told me this. They borrowed money from my grandmother for $600. They bought a house. They paid the house off. And from that day forward, my dad never had a house mortgage. He was able to wheel and deal, and he never had a mortgage. But the story is that we moved up here, and our first house was down by the Dog Track Road in Longwood at the intersection of 1792. It had a hand pump for water, and it's what they call a shotgun house. That means you could look in the front door and look right out the back door. That's how they were built then, bedrooms on one side. And then from there we moved on up into Longwood, rented a house, and in 1948, about 1950, I guess, my dad built a house, physically himself built us a house and raised 4 kids in that house for 21 years. And then after that, wasn't long after that time period, I went to Vietnam, and while I was gone, Mom and Dad moved to another house and then to another house. And to make a long story short, my dad has passed now, and my mother lives in assisted living here in Sanford at Renaissance Retirement.
So you did you go to Vietnam right after high school, or?
No, I was went to Vietnam in 67 and 68.
Were you drafted then?
I was drafted, yep, and I obtained the rank of sergeant, did the best I could, and came home. And in the military, I was a wheeled vehicle mechanic. And other than that, I was involved in the commercial fishing industry before I went to Vietnam, but not very much before. We went into the commercial fishing industry in about 1961. And I can tell you how that happened if you want to hear it.
Well, you said you were a mechanic in the
military.
Army. Have you always had an interest in that? Is that why you... All right, and would you like to continue? Were you about to?
Yeah, I was going to tell you. Did you want me to tell you how we started in the fishing industry, or did you want to go somewhere else?
What was the impact of the fishing industry like when you were younger, before you got into, before you went to Vietnam?
Exactly. Well, the way it happened was I had never heard of a commercial fisherman on the river prior to 1961 or thereabouts. My dad had a gas station at the corner of Airport Boulevard, which at that time was Honora Road, in 1792. The building still stands today. We were in the station with the gas station one day, and 2 men pulled in an old car, and they looked bad. And the old car was a 1937 four-door DeSoto sedan. Had no back seat. It was as big as a barn. It was a huge car, and they came in for gas, and my daddy walked out to that car and looked in the back of that car, and there were 2 garbage cans in the back, and they were full of catfish. Well, Clarence Coyer and Cecil Dowell were in that car, and they got to talking about those catfish. Well, our family's always loved to fish, but we never did commercial fishing. And when my dad found out that you could actually earn a living catching fish, it wasn't very long. The gas station was history, and we obtained ourselves a little boat. And we began to commercial fish.
So he sold the gas station to get a boat?
That's right. Right.
All right. So that was when you were in your teens or earlier than
early
that?
Early 20s. That was about 1961, 62, I guess, right along in there. Right.
So when you came back from Vietnam, did you get back into that industry, or were you like looking for other jobs before that?
No. As a matter of fact, when I went to, before I was drafted, I was involved with commercial fishing with my dad. He had his boat and I had my boat. Now these weren't big boats like you see in the ocean. These are just river skiffs, basically, is what we fished out of.
You remember about how long they were?
They went on from 14 to 16 feet. And some of them were flat bottom. And some of them are what they call a skipjack. A skipjack is just a small boat, usually with a big engine on, and it has a very sharp bow. So that when you carry a load in it, it'll break the waves on the rough lake, and it's safer. The flat bottom boats are better for calm water. So we got our two boats, and we went to commercial fishing. The kind of commercial fishing we did from approximately 61 to the time I went into the service, we used a trot line. Do you know what a trot line is? Yeah. Trot line is a very, very, very long piece of string with a lot of hooks on it. You see that in Perfect Storm. Storm. They're catching big fish. But it's the same theory. It's a long line.
And you just drag it along the...
No, they're put out.
Oh.
They're a quarter mile long. And you go down the line on your little boat, and you knock the fish in the boat, bait the hook back, and you go to the next hook, and so on until you progress down the line.
Was this... And this was in the Monroe?
At that time, that was Lake Jessup only.
Okay.
There were other fishermen doing the same thing. But my dad and I, at that time, fished out of Lake Jessup. We put our boats in... Tuscarilla Road used to run right down to the lake. It was a dirt road. And there were a bunch of wino commercial fishermen that lived there in the woods. Now, in that camp where they lived, they had a wooden nail keg, a wooden barrel, buried in the ground. And the groundwater seeped in through the cracks. And they would drink that water. And I saw maggots in that water. And they would live in this old camp. Well, at that time, we left our boats right there at the boat at the along the bank, because people didn't steal your stuff then. We'd just drive down there and get in our boats and go fishing and come back and beach the boat and go sell our fish down at the fish house. Right across the road from Lowe's, there was an establishment called Waits. I don't know how you spell Waits. Our last name was Waits Fish House, and there were a commercial fish distributor, and we would sell our fish at that fish house.
And where was this? What Lowe's?
Across the road from Lowe's in Sanford.
Okay. So.
About where the Walmart is.
Okay. So pretty much all the commercial fishing was done in the lake. It wasn't on the rivers usually.
Well, see, at that time we were fishing in the lake. There was commercial fishing in both lakes and the river and all up in North Florida. It was all statewide. But I'm just referring to what my dad and I did.
So how many fishermen usually were in the commercial fishermen in Lake Jessup?
Okay. Jessup, I'll say at any given time. People were running trot line. There might have been a dozen, I guess. But you see, when you're running trot lines at a quarter of a mile long, and you run three or four of them, it takes up quite a large area.
It seems like there might be a risk of them getting tangled. Was that ever a possibility with other?
Yeah. What would happen when one man would put his trot line unbeknownst to the other across his? There was a common courtesy that when you ran your trot line, it would pick his up, and you would tie them together. And then when he saw that, his line was on top of yours, so he would take his up, you see. Common courtesy.
So there was like a unspoken code, pretty much?
Yeah.
All right.
And sometimes it ended up in not so pleasant situations, but most of the time it worked pretty well.
Were there any...
physical altercations?
Or just like feuds or anything between...
There were always territorial wars on the lake. You know, I'm fishing this end of the lake. Well, you don't own this lake. You don't have a deed to it. Back and forth and so on and on. You know, you go fish over in that section. And I was here first. And that kind of childish bickering went on constantly.
Did it ever escalate above just shouting or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some cases it got physical. There were some boats sunk at different times. Hostility. But that was a rare occasion.
You say boats sunk. How exactly did that?
Well, there are stories. And, you know, I have to confess, I'm going to relay a story or two to you that were stories that were relayed to me. And I don't know how much foundation there is to them.
Okay.
But from that industry, I would say they're probably pretty well true. One of the stories is that one gentleman had his trot lines out. Now, these lines, you leave them, at that time, you would leave them in the water, and you would take the fish off and rebait the hook and go on down the line. So the line stayed in the water at that time. And this gentleman had his line out, and when he went out to his line, there were some people, sports fishermen, fishing out there, and they had his trot line up out of the water. Well, now this gentleman had a skipjack with a great big stack of motor on the back of it, and he probably running 100 horse or better. Boat probably run 70 miles an hour. So he pulled up to him. He said, "What y'all doing?" And they said, "We're taking some catfish off his trot line." He said, "Well, isn't that something?" And he fired that big motor up, and he made a big circle out there on the lake till he got her up running good and fast. And he cut that boat in half, and he put both of them in the water. So that kind of stuff would go on, you know, occasionally. But I got to tell you, my friend, that's a rare occasion. That didn't happen every day.
Were the did all the commercial fishermen kind of stick together when, if there was some kind of
confrontation?
What are sports?
Sports fishermen.
Sport, is that what you refer to them?
Yeah. You had commercial fishermen, then you had your sports fishermen. There was always a conflict there.
And you pretty much stuck together if there was any kind of...
Yeah, but we didn't gang up on people. Okay. We weren't that tight.
You weren't looking to...
But it was looking at it from the sportsman's objective is that they were right in their complaint that we had these lines all over the lake, and they're out there drifting for speckled perch, as some people call them, crappie. They're drifting deep, and their line get hung on it, and they're driving, and they wind it all in. Well, it's a trot line, and they get their motors all caught in them, so it was probably a nuisance. And at the same time, we go out to our trot lines and find them cutting too, and they're all tangled up, and the fish all make big balls out of the trot lines. So there was always some kind of a war going on out there, but it was usually verbal.
So how long did you have the lines out at a time, like when you went out on the lake? How long was that?
What we would do, we'd go out about daylight.
Okay.
We'd walk along the shoreline with a little net, and we would catch shrimp. There are brine shrimp that live in the river, if you didn't know that. They look like any other shrimp, but they're just smaller. And we would bait our trot lines with them. So we would put our lines out, bait them up, and we'd get probably maybe a couple weeks before we'd have to pull them back up and then re-hook them, you see. Put new hooks on the lines, because the hooks, after a while, they'll deteriorate, rust, begin to break, get dull. So you have to put new hooks on your trot line. So you would bring it in, put it in a big tub, bring it in, cut the old hooks off, put new hooks on, put it on a special rack that I'll tell you about later, and we'd go put the line back out in the water. Now, later on, this type of fishing, when I got back from Vietnam, I met a family that had come up here from Clewiston, and they were deep into commercial fishing all their lives. And they knew a technique that I did not know. And they would put their lines out at dusk and pick the line up in the morning and just knock the fish off of it. They would call it boating the line. They'd put the line in a tub. And they'd take the line home and put it on this rack I'm telling you about and repair any damage to it, jump it out at dusk, and the same process. They call that jump lining. Well, they taught me how to do that. This family just kind of took me in. They just liked me, I guess. And so they taught me how to jump line. So from that point, my dad and I kind of separated in that he remained in Lake Jessup doing what we call stay lining, or leaving them overboard. And I migrated up into the river in Lake Monroe, because now I started fishing at night. I started using different kind of equipment, different kind of light. My dad didn't use lights. He fished in the daytime. I started using lights, and I started jumping the lines out in the evening, picking them up in the morning, and playing all day. I was single and running crazy.
So about how old were you when you and your dad split up the boat?
That would have been about 1970, I guess, something like that. We didn't part enemies. I just took on a different kind of fishing. And for 10 years, after I got back from Vietnam, for 10 years, I lived on various kinds of boats on the river. I actually lived on the river. And Archie Smith at the Sanford Boat Works, finally I moved one of my boats into his marina. And after he talked to me for a while, he asked me if I would like to run his little store there on the weekends. And I said, sure.
It's like a bait shop? Or
What it was, no bait. It was what they call the ship store. They'd sell screws and hardware and bilge pumps, and because they had big yachts in the marina. So I went to work one weekend, and my next day off was a year later. I had to work 7 days a week, but I still fished at night. Archie's a great guy. This guy, you know Archie.
I'm trying to get an interview with them, actually.
You got to. You better have some time, though, because he's got a lot to tell you. He's a wonderful man. And anyway, I lived in a marina and worked at the marina for 5 years, but I was still commercial fishing and still living on my boat. But I bought and sold and back and forth different boats to live on, always making a profit. And I lived on boats for 10 years on the river, and that was a cool thing to do.
Sounds kind of nice, actually. Yeah. So the lines, that was pretty much the trout lines. That was the way to catch fish. You only used the nets for the shrimp and...
Okay, that's a good question. Now we're going to get into the part where we're going to talk about some poaching.
Okay.
With a trot line, basically you can't poach because it's all legal. But now, when I moved up into the river and I fell in with some friends up here, we began to do what they call monkey fishing. And most people don't know what... They don't know what monkey fishing is. It's just, I guess it's a local name we've given to it, but it's using an electric generator. And these generators generally come in the old field phone or an old crank telephone. It's an armature with a series of bar magnets stacked over the armature, and when it spins, it generates an electrical current. Well, my daddy had one of those monkeys, we call it, in his old shop when I was a little boy. Ran out of time. And I saw that thing laying in the shop for years. I didn't know what it was. Well, then when I fell in with these guys and I found out what a monkey was, I said, I've got one of those. And I went home and I took that monkey and I fastened it to a board and I hooked an electric motor to it. And brother, we went fishing. Now, when you turn that monkey on, if you turn it too fast, it doesn't work. If you turn it too slow, it doesn't work. There's a certain rhythmic impulse from that machine, which is relatively slow, that catfish can't stand it. It doesn't affect any scale fish. It doesn't affect eels, gar, brim, stingrays, nothing but catfish. And so we would go out at night with very powerful headlights. My light was a landing light off of an aircraft. It was about 500,000 candle power. And we would run that monkey. We'd put a wire over each side of the boat. And the fish would literally try to get out of the water. They come up to the top and they're running around, and we've got long poles with nets on them. We'd dip them up and put them in the boat.
So they'd be jumping out of the water?
Yeah, jump up on the bank. Some of them jump in the boat. It was crazy. We'd be laughing. It was funny. But it was illegal. I got to tell you, it was illegal. And we made a lot of money doing that. And so now I'll say this, and I want this to go on the record, because that monkey machine, as we call it, will not work in any water at all times. There are conditions that have to be favorable for its function. The water has to be low, basically a drought situation, wintertime low. Water has to be hot, disgusting, you know, nasty. Usually it's green with algae. But what happens in that process, and a lot of commercial fishermen don't understand this, the alkalinity in that water is magnified because the water volume is reduced, thus condensing the amount of alkalinity in that water. Now the river's a battery. It's a conductor. You put the two wires over it, and now you've got a current flowing, and as well as radiating, and it drives the fish crazy. If it rains a lot and dilutes that water, or the water's high, still diluted, you lose that connection, and it doesn't work at all. So we knew that it would only work in the summertime. But that's why. It has to do with the alkalinity and the acidity in the water.
This sounds like a kind of a complicated process. Is this something that most fishermen knew, or was it something like you guys just figured out after a while?
I think we all knew it, but I don't think a lot of the commercial fishermen, and I was one, so I guess. I wasn't of the same mindset of most commercial fishermen, I got to tell you. I'm not better than them. I just came from a different spoke of the wheel. I would investigate things. I take things apart now. I have an inquisitive mind. So I delved into why this thing worked. They don't give a hoot. All they care is if it works or it don't work. But anyway, that's why I was able to share with you why it works and why sometimes it doesn't. Now, I don't want to get long-winded, but I can tell you something else that's phenomenal about commercial fishing. There is a time of year that you will catch more fish on a trot line with no bait than you will with bait. And they would call it fishing empty hooks. And you ask a commercial fisherman, why is that? I don't know. Just this time of year, they buy the empty hooks. Well, I did some investigating. When acidic water is acidic water, as opposed to pure water, it's a good conductor. It's also corrosive. When you drop a metallic object into corrosive water, on whatever scale, it will begin to deteriorate. It's called electrolysis action. It rusts, it corrodes. When it does that, it puts out a minute electrical aura around that which is deteriorating. You understand that? Iron deteriorating in air when it gets wet is called oxidation. Metal deteriorating in water, going through the same process, I guess it's oxidation. It's a mixing of a metal with oxygen, but it occurs under the water, and it generates a small electrical charge. A catfish's whiskers are so ultra sensitive, he doesn't even need eyes. And I've got a book on this. I've read this, so I'm not just spinning you a yarn. They are so ultra sensitive, that in itself is why the monkey affects only catfish. And it won't affect any other kind of fish. Now, the state uses a generator to bring up scale fish to do a count. They're using an AC voltage where the monkey's putting out a DC voltage. And they use 110 volts, a different kind of electricity to affect the scale fish. But anyway, that's why a certain time of the year you can catch more fish on a trot line on empty hooks than you can with bait, because the fish goes for that electrical aura. That's how catfish can find food. They can actually find food by that. Any living thing has a small, you have electricity in your body. Well, I don't care how small a living organism is, it has an aura. And the catfish can find the food with that. So when they swim by that hook and they go, oh, this is lunch, and they grab it. And there'll be a fish on almost every hook. But the water condition has to be right. When that water's diluted, all of a sudden that doesn't work. We've caught thousands of pounds of fish on pink camay soap. And you could always tell when the fish were biting on pink camay soap, because you go into the store, all the soap displays are all crumbled because the commercial fisherman would pick up the bars of soap and shove his thumbnail in it. If he could push his thumbnail in it, the bar of soap was a nice, fresh, soft bar, and you could cut it up. If you couldn't push your thumbnail in it, he didn't want that one. So they'd destroy all the pink camay, and they would only bite on pink camay. So we've caught catfish in a commercial way on pink camay soap, shrimp, local shrimp here in the river, the brine or grass shrimp, snails. The bottoms of these lakes in the river are just literally covered with millions of snails. There's a certain way you get the snail out of the shell until you put it on the hook. Watermelon produces large channel catfish, but not many of them. But the thing of it is, would you rather clean 5 great big fish or 200 little bitty fish? So we would use watermelon sometimes. Watermelon, cantaloupe, was a good producer of large channel cats. I think that somehow the large channel cats, believe it or not, they must favor something sweet. I have a friend right now that's running trot line. Right now, today, he's baiting with corn, canned corn, and he's just cleaning house.
I would never imagine that.
Well, see, Darren is another reason I'm glad we're having this interview. And this stuff could go, that's why I asked you on the phone, could this be a long interview? This could go, I could tell you stuff like this for days, and you don't have that kind of time, let alone the amount of stuff on that machine. So anyway, therein lies that. And in Lake Monroe, we would do the trot line. Now, if you want, I'll get into other methods we caught fish.
So, well, let me just ask you this quickly. That device, the monkey, what would you call it, the monkey?
The monkey.
Okay. You said that wasn't really legal, technically?
Not legal at all. No way.
Was there, at that time, what kind of presence did the Fish and Wildlife have? Like, were they patrolling the rivers and the lakes a lot?
Yeah.
Like, did you have to watch out for them?
Very much so. That's a good question, Daniel. As a matter of fact, what we would do occasionally, sometimes we just went monkey fishing, but occasionally we would go down to, we would drive down to, Mullet Lake Park, or we'd go down to Harney, or we'd park right here across the river at 1792. We'd go to that park at night. Well, it's closed. We'd drive around behind the park and come up the back way, and we'd come under the fence, and we'd go down there to the boat ramp, make sure the game warden wasn't in. Now, if his truck was sitting there, we knew he was in the area. So if his truck wasn't there, and then we drove down to Mullet Park and it wasn't there, we had a pretty fair shot that he wasn't in our area, and we go monkey fishing. So, but the game warden
was kind of a risk, a little bit. Or
I'm sorry.
Was it kind of a risk?
Absolutely. Every time you went monkey fishing, it was a risk. But the game warden and the average commercial fisherman didn't have a real good rapport. I happened to have had a good rapport with the game warden. I respected him. He was a good man. A lot of guys didn't. And he almost caught me doing some illegal things, but he never caught me. He never caught me, brother. But anyway, the game wardens were always, it was like the old movies, Cowboys and Indians. The cowboys chase the Indians, or the Indians chase the cowboys. And it was that kind of a thing, you know. And but he'd catch you occasionally, catch somebody and write them up. And then there was always a dispute if he caught somebody doing something illegal in Lake Monroe. When they went to court, the commercial fisherman would say, well, where did you catch me? And he'd say, I caught you in Lake Monroe. And you would say, well, where in Lake Monroe did you catch me? Because the county line runs right through the middle of the lake. So, and then a lot of times it was thrown out of court.
So what were these other methods of fishing you were?
Now, there's fish traps at that time when I was doing that were illegal. And now, I didn't get into the trapping much.
What kind of traps were they?
Good question. A trap was made basically of chicken wire. Now, picture in your mind a round tube made of chicken wire, approximately 18 inches to 2 feet in diameter, 3 feet high, maybe 4. Now pinch one end of that tube shut. So it's seamed at the bottom, now it's open at the top, in which there is an inverted funnel laid on the side on the bottom of the lake with food in it. Catfish will go in the funnel, and they're too stupid to find their way out. They'll turn around, and now they're against between the trap and the funnel, and they can't get out. And they just continually fill up and fill up with catfish. And you would tie that to a long line, like a trot line. When you would run your trap string, as they called it, you pull the trap up, you unzip the bottom of it, dump your fish out, close it back up, threw some more bait in there, threw it back overboard.
And this was legal as well?
At that time, it wasn't. It is now. But at that time, trapping was not legal.
Is there a reason why that, do you know why that became illegal? It doesn't seem very harmful.
I don't know the particulars as to why it would be illegal, unless it would be because of the amount of fish harvested. Other than that, I don't know why.
Okay.
But I just know it was illegal. And if they would catch you, they would confiscate your traps, stomp them all down, and then put you in jail.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In jail?
If they caught you with that stuff, yeah. But a lot of people were doing it, but I never did the trapping.
You did?
I don't know why. I was always content to do the trot lining. I was a trot liner, and then I got into the monkey fishing. Now, there's another method of fishing that we used. Oh, this was fun, brother. Out off the coast of Florida, they do a lot of shrimping.
Mm-hmm.
Behind those boats, they pull what's called a shrimp trawl. Do you know what that is?
No.
Have you seen a shrimp boat?
Yes.
You got
yes.
The two things yeah. Sticking up here? When they're out in the ocean, they'll call outriggers. They drop them down. And from those, back behind the boat are two long ropes tied to a very wide mouth net. And it comes down to what they call a sock. It's wide at the beginning, and it comes down to a long tube. They drag that along the ocean bottom, and that's how they catch a shrimp that you put on your dinner table. We had a shrimp net. A trawl, as it was called. Well, we would pull the trawl on Lake Monroe with 100 horse mercury. Now, you couldn't pull it very fast because it was 35 feet wide and dragging the bottom. It had a cork line on top to hold the top up, and it had a lead line on the bottom to hold the bottom down, so it was bagged out, and you would drag that along the bottom of the lake, and you'd catch catfish that way. And that was easy pickings there, but it'd take a long time. But you see, you could get caught doing that too. You had to always be on the lookout for the game warden out there in the lake, and this was done at nighttime with no lights.
And you said you did participate in that kind of...
I'm sorry?
You did use that kind of method sometimes?
Yeah, yep. Pull a trawl on Lake Monroe, pull it right down the channel, and catch all kind of catfish. But once again, that was illegal. Very illegal.
You keep saying catfish. Is that pretty much all the catfish? That was pretty much the prize fish you...
Yeah. Now, catfish was a legal fish. Now, once you caught that catfish and took it to market, nobody cared. It was just a fish on the market. So if you trapped it, if you monkeyed it up, if you dug it with a trawl, or what, however, once you took it to market... It was fair game. How you got the fish was a different story. Now, there were a lot of brim captured with the trawl, traps, and sold on black market. The brim, you didn't have to clean them. You ice them down, and they went across the state line or wherever they went, and you could sell brim.
They weren't legal to sell? Or
not at all.
To catch? Or?
That's right. No game fish. Commercial fishermen were not allowed to have a game fish in his boat.
So what were the fish that were, aside from catfish, were... I mean, did you even bother with any other fish, or were there's like, was it like a smaller?
Oh no, we just focused on catfish.
Okay.
And if you really got desperate and wanted to make some money on the black market, you would catch brim and speckled perch, which is crappie. And I didn't get into that much. I stayed to basically the catfish.
Okay.
And did a lot of things illegally to catch the catfish. It was a lot of fun, made a lot of money. But you understand, in the commercial fishing industry, it's either feast or famine. You're making a lot of money in a very short period of time, but when you're not doing it and that money's gone, you've got to do it again to produce that kind of money, or you just got to get by the best way you can. So if your trot line's only producing a small amount of money, basically, whatever that figure might be, and the monkey or the trawls, the traps, are producing a lot, and you're not doing that fashion, that method anymore, now you've got to revert back to your trot line, which takes hours and hours to run, a lot of effort. You see, then you're going to gravitate towards the easy pickings. Now, the trot lines, they were on an average about a quarter of a mile long, about 1,300 feet long each, and we would run anywhere from 2 to 4 or 5 of those a day.
Okay. Were there any other... any other methods of catching a fish that you haven't gone over?
Yeah, one more. It's called a hoop net. It's a long net, much like the trawl, in the, what I call the sock or the tube area. It has no large, wide mouth like a trawl.
Mm-hmm.
It just has a round mouth with a funnel. This is all made out of string. It's netting. It has multiple hoops in it. It looks like a big caterpillar laying on the bottom, like a big sausage. And one end of it is tied off, pinched shut. The other end is wide open with the funnel, and the catfish will go in there. It's like, just like a large trap, only instead of being made of chicken wire, it's, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet wide, and it has fiberglass round hoops that are attached as ribs every couple of feet.
And this is being pulled?
That's just anchored in the river.
Oh,
like
okay.
A trap. And the fish will just go in it. And you go out there and pick it up and drag the fish out of it. That's illegal. I don't know that hoop nets are illegal now. That might not be. You see, what has happened, Daniel, is the farm-raised catfish. You're familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
Farm-raised catfishing industry has accelerated to the effect that it has shut down the wild commercial fishermen. Because people prefer restaurants. Big dealers are buying up farm-raised catfish. However, I will say this. Farm-raised catfish on the plate are distinctively different than those that came out of the wild. The fish, the flesh is relatively flabby and tasteless. And the reason for that, Daniel, is that the farm-raised catfish lays on the bottom of that pond where he's raised and he is fed. He doesn't have to move. He just eats and goes back and lays on the bottom. The wild catfish has to work for his food, and his muscle tone is good. The flesh is firm, and he has a better taste when you want to eat some catfish.
So catfish quality has pretty much declined over the years as a result of restaurants preferring raised fish?
Yeah. If you buy catfish fillet at a restaurant, you'll find it's edible, it's good, it is. I'm not knocking them. I'm just telling you that a wild catfish is better on the plate than a farm-raised catfish. It really is. So if you go to a restaurant that has wild catfish, which I think Black Hammock Fish Camp on the bottom end of Jessup there has, they're a lot better, and that's the reason why. It's not that I'm down on the farm-raised fish, it's just a matter of fact.
Well, you mentioned going to Lake Harney,
mm-hmm.
right? What was like your territory? Like how far did you go out on the lakes and the rivers?
My territory was basically Lake Jessup and the river connecting Lake Jessup and Lake Monroe and Lake Monroe. That was my territory that I fished. Well, other people did too, but just personally, that's just the area that I fished, a local area. No commercial fishermen fishes the entire length of 128 miles of the St. John River. So we all, you live in this town, you fish this section, and that guy lives in that town, he fishes that section. Because it's not practical to do that. But I just fished Lake Jessup and the river between Jessup and Monroe, and mostly Lake Monroe.
So you never outside of Lake Monroe, like north on the river?
Okay. No, but the I-4 bridge from there north, I've been up there, but not in a commercial fashion.
And I'm curious, when did you stop commercial fishing? What year?
It's a gray area, Daniel, because an industry like that, to where you see all the beautiful sunsets and the sunrises, and you're out there in nature at night, is so inviting to the typical guy. You get out of it, and you're back in it. And you're back out of it, and you're back in it. You meander. Nobody just quits commercial fishing one day. Because it gets in your blood, so to speak. It becomes in your fiber. But I'll say that I finally relinquished all commercial fishing on a commercial basis probably about 1971, something like that.
Oh, okay. So did you notice any, it might have been a little early in 71, but did you notice any effect of like pollution with more people moving to Central Florida? Was there any like effect on the water and the fish?
Yeah. Now, the answer to that basically is no, as far as the fish are concerned. But I, of course, through the years, being on the river as many years as I have, there's a lot more pollution. People camping on a riverbank and leaving old grills and beer cans and bottles up in the woods is disgusting. The way people actually treat the river now. Although I was a commercial fisherman, don't exclude me to the fact that where you think I don't have good sense, because I like to think that I do, and I'm an advocate for the river. And it offends me greatly when the river's abused. I see the erosion of the boat wakes. Now, nobody can help that. That's boat wakes will erode the bank and the trees fall in the water. That's okay. But the debris that people leave behind when they go out, they have a good time on the river, and they leave their trash on the riverbank. I've got a real, real problem with that. There's just no call for that. But anyway, to answer your question, as far as the fish are concerned, haven't seen anything negative reflect from the fish at all.
Did you know any other fish? Like, I don't know how far out you got. But did you know any fishermen from, like, I read in Lake Apopka, for instance, there was a pretty, with the pesticides used from the surrounding farmlands, it got pretty bad for a while. There was not really that much of that around here?
No, not here. It was bad in Lake Apopka. It really was. No, Dad, haven't seen that here. No, personally, I can't say that I have.
Okay.
The water quality comes and goes with the season. In the summertime, before the rainy season, water's low. Not all that inviting sometimes. Gets a lot of algae in it. Algae is a natural process. But now I'll tell you this. Away from the commercial fishing and just looking at the river itself, most of the time that I was commercial fishing, the hyacinths were a nuisance. Because the hyacinths would move. And a hyacinth produces a new plant, I think, every 72 hours. So they're prolific beyond compare, I guess. But there would be little acres or half an acre of hyacinths floating on the water, and you're trying to run a trot line up off the bottom, you pick that trot line up, and there sits a half an acre of hyacinths, you can't even get through it, it's impassable. That's a problem. So they were a problem, hyacinths were a problem to small boat navigation, they were a problem to the commercial fishermen. However, when the state began to spray the hyacinths, they would die and settle to the bottom. Now you try to run on a trot line and that, when you pick it up off the bottom, all those hyacinths that were floating on top are now rotting on the bottom, and they're all over your trot line. There's another problem. And they turn to silt, and it just gets worse and worse. But I've got to say, in defense of the hyacinth, I think water quality was better because the way they feed, they as they float through the water, have you ever seen the root of a hyacinth?
It's pretty long, right?
Yeah, and it looks like a feather. It's like a feather duster, and it hangs in the water. And as it moves along, it collects nutrients out of the water, and thus it cleans the water. So they have sprayed so many hyacinths, the state has, that I feel like that the water quality is not what it could be with the hyacinth. In other words, I don't have a problem with them spraying the hyacinths, but I think they've overdone it. They've virtually almost wiped them out.
Yeah, you don't really see them that much anymore,
no,
do you?
No, you don't. And the habitat, the shrimp and a lot of small fish would live up under the hyacinths and the roots, and the game fish were up there all the time. You could find a hole in the hyacinths and fish through that hole and just catch all kind of fish where there are no hyacinths. So it's good to look at, nice pretty water, but it's not as good as it could be. And that hyacinth is not a natural plant for Florida, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It came here, I think, from the Orient.
You mentioned earlier some altercations with other fishermen. Aside from the human aspect, were there any major like dangers with? I'd imagine there's some kind of dangers with commercial fishing, just natural dangers or just like the boat. Like what did you have to look out for?
Yeah. Okay. Dan, I'm glad you brought that up. One of the most agonizing injuries a commercial fisherman can get is to get horned by a catfish. A catfish has three horns or spikes, fins. Two out the side of each side of the head, and one up on the dorsal fin in the back. Now these fins they're designed in a way that they're serrated. They go in slick, but coming out is a different story because it has like teeth on the back side of it, all in one direction, allowing a smooth penetration, but a very painful extraction. And to get stuck by one and bleed a little bit, it hurts a little bit, and that's it. But if you get one jammed in all the way in or halfway through your hand, and you got to pull that thing out, that's a bad deal, brother. So anyway, that's a bad deal. And I'll tell you something that a lot of people don't know about a catfish. One of the things that creates the intense pain when one is stuck by a catfish is the slime on the fish. And the way I found that out is I had a cut on my hand one day when I picked up a catfish, and it just stung beyond belief, and I realized that had something to do with it. I don't think the catfish injects you with anything. I can't say yes or no. I don't think so.
Maybe but, like the bacteria or something?
Yeah. And infection is rampant. You need to get attention for a deep puncture wound from a catfish. But a catfish will hurt you. A stingray will hurt you. I didn't mess around with the alligators. I'm not of the mindset that I like to kill things. I kill the catfish to survive, but I'm not a hunter.
Well, yeah, you were on Lake Jessup a lot. Was the alligator population pretty big then, too?
Tremendous.
Did they pretty much just leave you alone?
Yeah, an alligator's a misunderstood animal. He's docile in his realm. He's shy. He'll stay away from you. Mm-hmm. I don't know, sometimes he's kind of curious. But he won't come up to you. He'll stay off some distance and watch you, and that's about it.
Even you started in the early morning, right? Mm-hmm. They're pretty active then. They'd still just kind of ignore you?
Yeah, you'd see them out there, see their heads up out on the lake, mm-hmm. and they're just trying to catch a garfish or a turtle or something, you know. They're not the aggressive animal that the media has made them out to be.
Mm-hmm.
You corner an alligator, he's going to try to hurt you.
Or just mess with its nest or something.
Yeah, that's right. But if you leave the gator alone, he wants to get away from you. He don't want to be around a human being. On the other hand, people that feed the gators, they're asking for trouble. That's a different scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But in the wild, an alligator, he's not going to come charging up and jump in your boat and all that stuff, whatever you might have heard. They're docile. And I should say, I can't say docile. They're hostile when they are challenged.
Mm.
But other than that, they don't.
You worked with your father. Was there more crew than just you and your father, I'm assuming?
Just my dad and I.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he had his little boat, and I had mine, and he ran his trot lines, and I ran my trot lines, and I lived with my dad.
So even when you went off into Lake Monroe, it was just you?
Well, just about you that time's when I started living on the boats.
Okay.
And so I had left home. At that.
But you didn't have any, like, deck hands or anything?
No, because the boats were too small. It was only big enough for one boat. You put a lot of that commercial fishing equipment in the boat, and there is no room for anybody else. Because you've got trot line, what do you call, racks and long hooks and buoys and all this fishing equipment, lights and batteries and all kind of stuff in the boat. So a boat's only 14 feet long. There's not a whole lot of room in there. So you walk over all your stuff to go from one end of the boat to the other. And the trot line, by the way, is run from the bow. You sit right up in the bow, if you didn't know that, to run the trot line. And the boat just kind of follows along as you go down that trot line.
Okay. So since it was just you in the boat, did you have to kind of, I guess you knew what you were doing, but did you have to take care that you didn't hurt yourself or fall out or something? Nobody watching your back, pretty much.
Well, that's right. You're out there by yourself a lot. Yeah, you know, and that is good. You didn't want an explosion or a fire in your boat, which I never heard of that happening, but you wouldn't want that out there by yourself. But I think the main thing you had to watch out for is every commercial fisherman had a knife. It was a tool, and you could get cut, which I have done. You get a pretty bad cut. Or, at times, when you're baiting a trot line, when you grab this hook to bait it, you let it go out this side of the boat as you're going down the line. You follow me? Mm-hmm. So you grab this hook, you bait it, you let it go, and you grab this hook. Now you're spread eagle. When you come together the line for the next pull, when you let that hook go, it's a crucial moment because if the wind's blowing, and this has happened to me and my dad, you pull that hand back, and that hook will bury itself right there in the palm of your hand because it's flopping in the wind. And you pull your hand back, it's got you. So then you cut that little, it's called a braylon. You have the trot line, you have a little string hanging down with a hook on it. You would cut that little string off, leave the hook embedded in your hand, finish your work and come home and go to the doctor and have him cut it out. But what I would do, I'd just get a pair of pliers, jerk it out, and he'd pull out a hunk of meat. I wasn't going to go to the doctor. I'm not big and bad. I was cheap. I wouldn't go to the doctor. But we'd pull it out.
Oh, man. Well, do you have any other stories you'd like to share?
I mean, a lot, but I can't take up your whole day, brother.
One time
when I was married, I came home from the lake and I had exactly that scenario.
All right, sorry about that. You were about to start.
Yeah, that's fine. We're talking about injuries or potential injuries. And only because you asked me, I'll tell you this story. But I came home that one day and I had a hook buried in the palm of my hand with that little, what they call a braylon or drop, that little piece of string on it. And as I said, at that time I was married. Well, outside we had a clothesline in a T-fashion pole on each end. Mm-hmm. So I knew she wasn't going to pull that out of my hand. So I took a concrete block and I tied a string to it. And I set it right up on the top, the center of that T on that clothesline. And right beside the clothesline was my truck. So I laid my hand on the truck and I tied a loop around that hook. And I held the shank down on this side where it would pull that hook out reverse. And I called her out in the yard. And I said, push that concrete block off that clothesline. And she looked at that scenario and saw that line coming down to my hand and saw that hook, and she wouldn't do it. And I insisted. So she finally tipped that concrete block off and went over the side of that clothesline pole. And when that line tightened up, brother, that hook come out of that hand and it pulled a hunk of meat out the size of an English pea. It put a hole in the middle of my hand.
It seems like you would have a lot of scars from this industry.
But you know, there's probably so many scars, they just all run together. Now, I'll tell you, you want to hear, here's a scar. That scar runs from that middle finger down around here, and it comes around here, and it goes right through here. Well, my friend had a skipjack, fiberglass skipjack. It's a boat I told you about earlier.
Yeah.
And it was brand new. It didn't have the bow cap on it. Boat comes to a point at the bow and you have a little cap that goes on it right there. It's a decorative cap over the bow. It's usually aluminum or something like that. Well, now you've got this boat with bare fiberglass bow sticking out there like this, and it's sharp. I was right there in front of the Sanford Boat Works and my friend was running the boat, and because he just got it, he wanted me to stand on the bank and watch the boat run by to watch how she was running in the water. So he ran by a couple of times, and then he wanted me to run it so he could stand on the bank and watch it run. So I ran the boat, and then when I came back, he wanted to do it one more time. So he ran the boat, and the wind was blowing that day. And I was standing on right at the water's edge. Water was low. There was a bluff bank about 4 feet high right to my rear. So the bank came at one level, dropped 90 degrees down to a very short 4 foot beach to the water. You follow me?
Yeah.
So now I'm standing on this little beach in front of this big bluff bank behind me. My friend makes a circle and comes back with this boat with 80 horse mercury on it. And he slows it down. He's just going to let it come right down to the beach here. Well, as he came in a little bit hot. So I reached out to get hold of the bow of the boat to slow it down as it come in. And it just shoved that hand right into that bank and it almost took those two fingers off. And that's what those scars are right there. It just about amputated that half of my hand when that boat pinched my hand between the bow and that dry muck bank back there.
It seems like you had a lot of injuries with your hands. Didn't that, like, prevent you from doing basic boating?
Yeah, that'd cripple you up for a while. It sure would, boy.
Did you ever have to, like, stop fishing for a while?
Yeah, I was skinning fish one time. The way we cleaned the fish, you would take the fish, you cut him right behind the head here on both sides, and we have a reverse hook on a ramp. So you got a little ramp, a reverse hook on it. You would hook that fish on that hook, take a pair of skinners, and pull that hide off that catfish and throw him in the stack, and then you would take his head off and gut him, and he goes into the last process, you see. Well, I was skinning fish one night at the Sanford Boat Works. I had a little hook set up out there, and right under my hand right here is what we call a red cat. Now, a red cat is a what they call, some people call them brown bullheads, spotted catfish, and they have red meat. The meat's red, but it's good. And that red cat was right there, and I was skinning that fish. Well, the skinner slipped off the hide, and my hand went right down the back of that fish, and that fin was sticking up I just told you about. And it went almost through my hand. When I got that taken care of, being like usual, not going to a doctor, I rubbed some stuff on it, bandaged it up, and I was crippled up. Well, I couldn't hardly use that hand. Well, in about 3 days, it got all swelled up. My fingers got real tight, like they were going to split open. And it got red, boy. I mean, it was hot. And finally, I went to the doctor, and the doctor got all over my case. He said, 24 more hours, we'd have taken that hand off. He said, you got blood poison in that hand. He was not nice to me. He seemed like he was offended, but they pumped me full of antibiotics and got that taken care of. And I'll tell you another time, a stingray, I had a stingray on a hook and I was trying to take him off because I didn't want to hurt him. And that was not a smart thing to do. So I rolled my hand under his back and turned him belly up, thinking he couldn't get me with that tail that'd be hanging out here in the air. And I'm over here trying to take that hook out of his mouth. And he run that spike right in that knuckle right there and buried it in that knuckle and gave me a good shot of his poison. Well, I was bleeding pretty good, and I got rid of that scenario, cut the string and threw him over. And that time I had a girlfriend. She was out there with me. And she said, you better go in and have that taken care of. And I'm like, no, that's all right. I'm okay. Well, we kept fishing, and after a while, my wrist got to hurting. And then my elbow got to hurting, and I started rocking. You know, I didn't want her to see it. She said, you're hurting. We better go right now. So by the time we got to the boat ramp, I couldn't hardly get the boat trailer up on the boat because now it's hurting up here under my shoulder. And we went right straight down, right to my house and parked the boat and got in her car and took me to the hospital. And they gave me an IV of Benadryl, morphine, and some other stuff because of the infectious poison that a stingray has. So that's another thing a commercial fisherman doesn't want to do is a stingray.
I didn't know there were freshwater stingrays, and this was in the lake?
Lake Jessup, Lake Monroe are just thick with stingrays.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah, if you fish with worms or a protein-type bait, worms, shrimp, snail, meat of any kind, throw out there on the bottom, you've got a good chance of catching a stingray. Now, I know you're running out of time, but I'll tell you how the stingrays got here. Because a lot of people don't know, and I'm a reader. Mm-hmm. I read. I'm not very educated, but I try to educate myself. And I read a book by Bill Belville, and he wrote this book on nothing but the St. John's River and the history thereof.
Do you remember the title of it?
Yeah, River of Lakes.
Okay.
And the St. John's River originates over there just west of Melbourne. And at one time, the St. John's River used to run directly into the Atlantic Ocean in an easterly fashion. The whole east coast of Florida literally rose up. This is probably millions of years ago, but they've done studies and they know this, thus forming the St. John River Basin. And the river had to go somewhere, so it meandered and it found its way out at Jacksonville. Now, when it did that, it encapsulated a lot of salt water. It was a saltwater marsh. Well, those stingrays were there. There were stingrays, there were mullet, and there were seahorses, and there were all kind of saltwater animals living in this saltwater marsh that eventually turned into the St. John's River. Mm. So these stingrays that are here, most people think they come up from Jacksonville. They didn't come up from anywhere. They've always been here. So that's how the stingrays, the American eel, small seahorses, a few, not many,
really?
Mullet, stripers, croakers, or saltwater fish. There had been sightings of tarpon in Lake Harney.
And a lot of these, they stay on pretty low to the, like the lake bed, so they're pretty much out of the sight a lot, right? Like the stingrays and the eels.
Yeah, they're bottom dwellers.
Yeah, so yeah. A lot of people wouldn't know that they're there.
That's right. I mean, a stingray can swim clear up to the surface.
Yeah.
There are stingrays in the ocean that will jump clear of the water. But these stingrays, if you're not looking for them, you basically don't know they're there. But you don't want to step on one of them, brother, because he'll put that spike in your ankle. And these aren't large stingrays like in the ocean. They're only about, a big one might be a foot to 14 inches wide. It'll be a big one.
Learn something new.
They're a nuisance on a trot liner. Because if you don't float that trot line up off the bottom, where they'll swim under it, if you put that bait on the bottom, my gosh, you'll have a whole string of
Do they ever get caught in the traps, or like eels ever get in those traps? Or
that's a good question. There are actually some of the commercial fishermen, which I never did, they have what they call eel pots. They have designed traps to actually catch the eels here, and they send them to England. They eat a lot of eels in England. They do some kind of jelly with their eels or something crazy. I don't know, but it's called, he's called the American eel. He's harmless. And a big one would be probably 2.5 feet, I guess. But they actually, it seems like they have actually shut down eeling in Lake Monroe for some reason. Population's down. I don't know what it is, but for a long time, the commercial fishing was putting out eel pots or eel traps and trapping the American eel as well.
Well, let me just ask you one last question, kind of on a personal note. Could you just tell me, it seems like you have a lot of experience on the lakes and the water. Personally, what was your favorite aspect of it, like nature aspect, or just your personal opinion? I would love to know.
I'm glad you asked me that, because I have an answer that's going to be different than probably any commercial fisherman that you interview. Only because it's different, not because my opinion is better. I'm a humble guy. I'm not in this for the heroes. But many a night when I would get through running my trot line, baiting it. Sometimes I put the trot line out and then bait it out there and go home. Well, sometimes it might be a full moon or thereabouts. It's beautiful out there. When I got through working out there, I'd take my boat and I'd go all up in the nooks and crannies with my big light and watch the wildlife. And I could tell you some alligator stories. An alligator attacked my boat one night, but it was my fault. I provoked him, but it's too long. I'll tell you later. Anyway, I would appreciate nature. I saw a rabbit one night on the bank in a place called Woodruff Creek. And the rabbit was on the riverbank eating a piece of grass. Just one long piece of grass. He was just sitting there. And a rabbit can eat a piece of grass and never move his hands. He'll just kind of ingest the whole thing. He was doing that. And the grass was getting shorter and shorter. But the unique thing about this particular rabbit was, when I shined the light on him, I wish I'd have had camera photography ability to take a picture, there was a halo of mosquitoes around this rabbit that were illuminated by the light. He didn't pay them any mind at all. They can't get to his fur, you see. So he was just, they didn't matter. But the mosquito sensed that he was there, but they couldn't get to him. Mm-hmm. So the rabbit was eating his grass in the nighttime. And this big, giant halo of mosquitoes, not blind mosquitoes, these were bloodsuckers, trying to get to this rabbit. And I just, that picture in my mind will never go away. He just
stuck
was
with
having
you.
Dinner.
Well, thank you for talking with us and coming in. Definitely take a lot of this. So, again, thank you for coming in and talking.
Well, it's been a pleasure. But the downside is, I just regret that the history that is going to be missed, because we only had an allotted time to do this. And I'll still try to put some things together on paper, and you can drop by, give them to Miss Kim up there or something. I want to draw you some illustrations as to how the trot lines are made.
Oh, that would be great.
Now, I've thought about donating that monkey to you guys. I guess I mentioned that earlier. Are you interested in having that machine?
Oh, yeah.
It's about that long.